accession number 9338, reel 10.
Doug Turner, tape 10.
One of the incidents which occurred was in the little village of Dongxi, in where we had provided sufficient resources for them to purchase a number of animals, and the scheme was functioning quite well when one morning one of the peasants appeared in my own village where I was living with a sad tale. During the night, one of the draft oxen had been stolen. My immediate reaction was one of suspicion. Well, you know, what's behind all this? Why should it suddenly be stolen like that? And were they wanting another animal in replacement? And my initial response was to say, well, I'm sorry, you know, if you're wanting another animal to replace this one, I'm afraid it's not on. And he immediately saw the point of my question and hastened to assure me that this had been a genuine theft and they were not looking for it to be replaced. They had felt it their duty to come and inform me that the animal had been taken and that they had all gone out to look for it, and they would keep me informed. So I accepted this in good faith, although, as I say, my initial response had not been perhaps all that
trusting.
All that trusting. Anyway, towards the end of the day, they came over and informed me, yes, they had found the draft animal. They had found it a bit in a village about 10 miles away. So, still rather curious, I said, well, and what happened? They said, well, we went to this village and there we saw it tied up in the street. And so we just untied it and brought it back. And I said, well, yes, that's good. I'm pleased about that. But what did you do towards discovering the thief? And they looked at me and they looked at one another. And then one of them turned round and he said, very quietly, Teng Shen Sheng, that village was much poorer than ours.
And that explained it to you?
Yeah. Another moment of my own biting the dust.
I was wondering, you know, you were rebuilding this area, in particular that, you know, particularly that town. What was the government attitude towards your role there? Did you have any interference?
No, we didn't have any particular interference from the government.
Would this have been the nationalist government?
Yes, indeed. Our relationships there would have been, of course, primarily with the provincial government, and they accepted what we were doing and gave support wherever they ever could. There was a time when Lady Cripps came to visit China on behalf of the then British United Aid to China Fund, and she came along to visit our own programme and was very impressed, and also played a very real part in enabling us to obtain bricks to develop our own programme, because the Chinese military forces were taking away the bricks which of old buildings which had been brought down to build up barriers against the communists, much to the detriment of the people's own needs. And she intervened here when we brought this to her attention. And there was one amusing incident when, after she had paid a visit to our main centre in Jungmu, she was then due to come across to visit the programme at our little village of Shirley Toe, and I went ahead to prepare for her arrival, and as I entered the village in the jeep, all the firecrackers went off in the expectation that it was Lady Cripps herself. So that by the time she did arrive, no firecrackers were left. The local government official was not amused, and he gave me a very unhappy stare.
Was that taken very seriously? You know, it implies that it was the fact that a welcome
they took
was
it,
laid on.
Yes. I think they were not amused. It was their mistake. But understandably, I mean, they wanted to give all the glory to their favoured visitor, Lady Cripps, not some wild bearded foreigner who was merely doing the work.
And her trip, you know, that was taken. It was an important thing, was it, for the
town? It was quite
town.
Important to them, yes, because I mean, whenever an important foreign visitor lay down, the red carpets were laid down too.
What did you think yourself of that trip? You know, did you meet Lady Cripps?
Yes, indeed.
Yes, what
indeed.
Did you think of her? And
oh,
her
I think
entourage?
She was a very deeply concerned person. From that, I mean, many years later, I mean, we were still writing letters to one another, and I still have letters from her there in my own files. She came later to Ghana, where I was again able to meet her, and we
did
maintained
she seem,
a regular
you know,
relationship.
Able to understand China?
Oh, yes,
and
very
the reality
much so.
Of it,
she,
do you think?
She was very grassroots minded, through the bureaucratic situation.
Can you remember the team she had with her? Who was with her when she came to your area?
I think herself, her daughter Peggy, and I believe my own colleague, Michael Harris.
Did you get any of the money from the fund?
Yes, this, of course, went to the unit.
I was wondering how you did cope for finance, you know, building your hospital and the other sort of restoration work doing.
Yes, by this time, of course, we were raising funds in the home countries, particularly UK and America, and America was now beginning to come in as a more dominant overseas supporter. More Americans were coming out, and the American Friends Service Committee was beginning to become much more positive towards the work which was going on, and we began to make a much wider appeal to the general public in the home countries.
I understand there was quite a high rate of inflation in China from this time. Is that right? And if so, did it affect your programme at all?
Well, there were always problems with, of course, the rate of exchange. This used to go up by leaps and bounds. One of my colleagues was once carrying the staff wages over from one sector to another, and I met him on the way, and he was weighed down with a huge rucksack. And I said, well, what have you got in your rucksack? And he says, all Chinese currency worth about £10 in English money. But thousands and thousands of Chinese dollars, of course.
Did the Civil War, when it broke out, did it have any effects on your life in Chung Mo? Were you directly affected by it?
We were at a later stage, yes.
When were you aware that it had broken out again? The
well, it had been going on, of course, all the time at different levels, you know. It had never really ended. I mean, there were always the snipings going on and local battles going on along the Yellow River itself and along quite undrawn lines. Towns would be taken and occupied and then retaken. this was pretty constant, I think. The piece was a very uneasy piece. And as the tension grew, then and the army's strength grew, little doubt, I think, that the Kuomintang forces did not want any kind of a compromise, but then neither did the communists. So they felt that so long as Chiang Kai-shek was in charge, then the country would never be united. We weren't, of course, involved in this, but we were aware of the political situation and took a very keen interest in what was happening.
Yes, you said earlier, when we were in West China, how a group had gone up to Yan'an with the communists. Would this have been about the time while you were in Chengdu?
Yes, this actually took place when the negotiations were continuing via General Marshall. They very kindly allowed one of the planes to be used to take the team of medical men up.
Can you remember who they would have been?
There were two doctors amongst the group which went up, Dr. Peter Early and Dr. Doug Clifford, one of our New Zealand members, a couple of medical mechanics, and a nurse, and I think a total of seven altogether. They flew up with the aid of General Marshall's peace plane, as we called it, and began to work in the international hospital in the caves of Yan'an.
Did you know anything about that yourself? You know, did you meet any of the people who'd been to Yan'an?
Oh, yes, indeed. I knew all of them, of course.
What sort of impression did it make on them?
Oh, they were very deeply impressed. They were quite impressed with the discipline of the communists, the troops, and also the civil structure which they had erected. Indeed, the top-level communists were quite surprised that the team was ever able to arrive, and they received a very warm welcome, which continued the whole time they were there.
And I believe you said they were evacuated when the Kuomintang went into Yan'an.
They had to retreat with the communist forces and spent many months on the trail, carrying their patients by stretcher, carrying the whole hospital by stretcher, in fact, and erecting it wherever they could. Fortunately, one of the members had a camera and film with him and was able to, at a later stage, have a film strip made of their experiences, which certainly gives some insight into what must be quite a historical experience.
Did you see that yourself?
Yes. A very simple film, but quite effective in perhaps relating to a public otherwise unaware of what was happening in the further reaches of the world.
I wonder where one could get that film. Have you any idea?
I don't have at the moment. I think that the firm which made it may now well have been taken over by another company, but I have not been able to trace it. It should be about somewhere. It was made for the member on a commercial basis, and it should be available. The name of the firm concerned then was called Common Ground. There is another Common Ground organisation, but that's nothing whatsoever to do with this particular firm which produced that film.
Could I ask you now about your relationship with the other relief agencies? You know, there was UNRWA in this area, and can you think of any other relief agencies you worked with?
Well, the UNRWA was actually, of course, handled by SUNRWA, which was the Chinese National Relief and Rehabilitation Administration. They were the Chinese end of the UNRWA setup. We had quite a good relationship with them. Of course, they had the money. We were doing the work. When they did visit our project in Jungmu, they were very deeply impressed with this and said, well, we must try and do something like this. This is something worthwhile doing. And I understand that they put in some quarter of $1 million, I believe, into a similar scheme, which somehow just didn't take off, because I don't think it had the same level of commitment. I think it was trying to operate as an imitation of what was a deeply felt concern, and failed at a more professional level.
Did you get, you know, did you form any opinion as to how their funds were spent, UNRWA? Did you sometimes feel, you know, that perhaps they weren't always put to the wisest use?
I think this tends to happen in any officially oriented aid administration. We're seeing this today, perhaps all over the world. Questions are raised, and surely it must have happened in China, particularly with all the corruption which existed. It's one of the unfortunate tendencies perhaps of bureaucratic structures to be shown to be producing results, and that results are always and inevitably produced. With what effect, ultimate effect, can only be left to history to decide. Undoubtedly some good must come out of much of the money, but as always, question marks are left perhaps hanging over much of the expenditure. In the smaller oriented projects such as our own, I think it's much more likely that there's less likely for money to be ill-used or wasted. But I think this is an inevitable human factor in the bureaucratic approach.
Could I ask you now about the Civil War? You know, when the fighting intensified between the two sides, did this affect your situation at all?
Yes, it began to. I was on the point of departing, and already the communists were beginning to move around the area, but still quite a few miles away, although some of the unit sections had already been involved in areas of the fighting.
What date would that have been?
This would have been during 1947. And reports were coming through, and but it meant perhaps an occasional occupation of an area. It might be where a Kalazar team was working, and they would go into a town on one of their visits, and it was occupied by the nationalist forces. The next time they went in, it was occupied by the communist forces. This kind of thing was developing more and more. And not long after I departed, in fact, our own program was taken by the communist areas, and all our animals were taken away, and all our supplies were taken by the communists on the grounds that they were going to be given to the people, much to the consultation of our members indeed. Chinese members were quite upset by what was happening, and they made their own protests, but at that time to little avail. After all, the all the communist sectors were aware of what the unit was or what it was trying to do, and probably saw us as just do-gooder foreigners operating to the detriment of the people.
Did you meet communists yourself? Did you ever meet them?
I met individuals who claimed they were communists, yes. And I have little doubt that some of our own members were becoming more and more aware of the need for a new structure in China were becoming inevitably more sympathetic towards a new order. The old order was drawing to a close, and something had to replace it, and there seemed little alternative other than a communist regime. There was no middle way.
And yet it would seem, you know, that numerically and regarding resources, the Kuomintang were very much stronger, weren't they? Why do you think it was that the...
Oh, there's little doubt the Kuomintang armies were completely demoralised. The communists were... Their efficiency was far, far beyond Kuomintang mentality. They were quite ruthless, of course, when they did take over a place. But they made sure things functioned. And they did function. I think, although we were quite impartial and deliberately so and politically so and wisely so, there was, I think most of us would have recognised as individuals that a new order was beginning to take shape and had to take shape, and we wished to continue with our policy of working with all who would be willing to accept our own approach.
Did you find it was a problem to remain neutral when you began to take sides like this?
Well, emotionally, I imagine most of us had our own sympathies. Clearly, there were those who probably felt that the communists did offer a threat to their way of life. Many of them, of course, as Christians, may well have suffered under communist regimes of the past, wherever their families had been involved. This is understandable, and their own fears were valid. This is always a question of the problem of civil war in any country. Loyalties are divided and torn apart, and who is to say who is right and wrong when your own family have been suffering from one side?
I often think when we look at Chinese history, you know, people who weren't actually there, that we see it in terms of the communists against the Kuomintang. But would you say that there was disaffection against the government by groups who weren't necessarily communist?
Oh, yes, I think this was a growing feeling. Although the Kuomintang was supposed to be a collection of different parties under one main party, the Kuomintang, there's little doubt that the clique at the top was determined to dominate all opposition. If they wouldn't accept the Kuomintang regime, then ipso facto, they must be communists, so that anyone who might suggest that he supported some kind of liberal democracy had no chance at all. It was an either-or situation. This was inevitable.
Was there any signs of student unrest while you were in China at this time?
Yes, there was indeed. This was a growing problem. In the big cities, the students were beginning to make their voices felt. It may well have been that some of them were managed by communists. I wouldn't say this is a rule this out. But my own impression was that most of them were deeply concerned about the welfare of their country. Many of them had given up their studies in order to support the Chinese, their government during the war, and they wanted to see some results of it afterwards, and the results weren't forthcoming. on one occasion I was invited to give a talk to a group of university students by one of our Chinese medical students, and I said, well, what do you want me to talk about? Of course, obviously, I mean, we couldn't become involved in the political situation. And he said, well, come along and talk about anything. I said, well, I just can't come along and talk about anything, you know, would you like to suggest something? And he said, well, come along and talk about democracy in your own country then. So I accepted the invitation, rather reluctantly, but he was so enthusiastic about it. And I went along, and the lecture hall was absolutely crowded out. There must have been almost 1,000 students there, I should think. It seemed enormous to me anyway, and they all sat there. And I was quite uncertain as to how much English they might or might not know, and I gave a very rambling discourse trying to explain British democracy to a Chinese audience, and I'm quite sure they didn't understand a word I was saying in any way. It was a most rambling discourse I gave, and at the end of it I invited questions, thinking that was the best way to make communication, and I got one solitary question who stood up and said, well, what would you suggest the students do in the present situation? And this rather unnerved me, and I said very uncertainly, well, I suppose the only thing you can do is to make your protest felt, as in the way you see the situation. And the very next day, the whole of the university was on strike. Not a coincidence, but it unnerved me, I can tell you. I'm sure it wasn't just because of what I said. I'm sure the strike must have been already planned, but it left me completely unnerved. And for the next few days, I spent my time praying that I wasn't going to be visited by the secret police. However, my experience, to me it was a very rather unhappy experience, but I got a little bit of a boost later on when one of my own comrades mentioned that he had also been invited to speak at the same university and had precisely the same response, but he hadn't even had a single question.